Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Deepest Lore. The previous episode received in the past week 21,000 views, so it easily, and I mean easily, made the 7,800 threshold. Adam Curtis is safe for another week. 7,800 is the threshold yet again today, and it will remain the threshold going forward. You know, my whole plan for Adam Curtis season, not only did I want to do it, but I wanted it to revitalize Deepest Lore. And I would say it's been, you know, a bit of a ratings hit. So that's good. It's been extremely interesting as well. I am a little bit worried about getting to the more recent ones about copyright, but we'll have to cross those bridges when they come. Sorry, I'm a little bit late. I was playing RimWorld and completely forgot that I had a stream. I am currently running a RimWorld game run by psychopathic lesbian witches. And they currently have two slaves who they forced to do most of the farming work around the place. They've adopted a little child, a girl, who they're training up to be a witch, who does a lot of the cleaning around the place. Oh, it's turning into a lovely dystopian hellhole. Anyway, do buy my courses at the Academic Agency, join the channel, like and subscribe, and all those other good things. We are on part two of The Living Dead, which is called, it's got a funny title, what was the title again? You Have Used Me as a Fish Long Enough, which is usually a quote from I've noticed that the title is often a quote that somebody says in one of the clips. So that's what I'm guessing. Ostensibly, this is about CIA methods of mind control and brainwashing, which is an extremely appropriate topic for The Deepest Lore, which has always been a show that is extremely interested in propaganda, if you look down its long history. All right, let's make a start. Awesome start to the stream. I reckon these are commies. I spotted a lot of commies that I recognize. Pretty sure that was Ceausescu there, Brezhnev at the start. Tell me if I'm wrong. I think this is like the International Communist Convention in 1960-odd.
This is a story set in an age that is now gone. The Cold War. It is about a
absolutely vintage Curtis opening. That was probably the best Curtis opening we've seen so far. Absolutely vintage. They believed they were living in a utopia, but this was a fantasy. Let's carry on.
A group of scientists who believed that they had found, for the first time ever, a way of controlling the human mind. They were convinced they had discovered how to change human memory, how to alter the way memories of the past were stored in the brain. If they could do this, they would have the power to free human beings from the past. They could wipe the memories of terrible experiences that drove people to violence and insanity. It meant that the dark forces of history that led to war and destruction could be controlled.
This was a fantasy.
But their dream became... They found themselves in a strange world in which nothing could be trusted. Not even their own memories.
This is some dark shit right here.
In 1938... A neurosurgeon in Montreal began a series of operations on patients who suffered from epilepsy. His name was Wilder Penfield.
In that operating theater, Dr. Wilder Penfield would perform his brain surgery. What he would do very basically is literally he would cut the skin, take the skin flap back, roll it back. He would then literally remove the skull, the top part of the skull. The patient all this time is under a local anesthetic, completely conscious.
And there was the surface of the brain visible right in front of our eyes. I had a bunch of electrodes on the brain recording its electrical activity. And then we put an electrode on, stimulate the...
Sure, if I can watch this. Fucking hell.
Temporal lobe, and suddenly they would...
Oh,
be transported. I can't see this. Remember some experience they had many, many years ago.
Oh.
It would be very vivid to them, just like a dream.
Penfield had begun the operations to investigate epileptic seizures, but he found something that no one had predicted. He seemed to be able to turn human memories on and off at will.
How?
From my own point of view, the most unexpected finding was to discover that a mild electrical current applied to the surface of the brain causes a patient to have a memory from his own past sometimes.
Good. Make it one volt, please.
One. Oh, this is horrific. Fucking hell.
Yeah. One volt.
I heard what sounded like an orchestra playing. And I asked the nurse where it was coming from. And she said, "What music?" And I said, "Well, that music." And then it stopped.
Then I stimulated it again, you remember, and asked you about it, and you hummed it. Will you hum it now? You remember it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Da 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 da.
Yes, and then when you got to that point, the nurse exclaimed, "I know what it is. It's rolling along together." And you said what?
And I said, yes, that's what it is.
And now?
Penfield was convinced he had discovered how memories were stored in the brain. There were patterns in the neurons, like electrical circuits. By touching the right point, he could play back what he called time's strip of film.
This is some properly dark shit. This is some dark stuff right here, folks. My God. Where was he in Toronto, this guy?
Towards the end of the war, Penfield invited a psychiatrist called Ewan Cameron to come and join him in Montreal. Cameron was fascinated by Penfield's work. He believed that if it was possible to change memories, one could produce better, more rational human beings.
Cameron was, in a way, a dreamer. He was a great pragmatist, but he was also a great dreamer. He thought that psychiatry should not just concentrate on sick people, mentally ill, but should actually go into government, that politicians should listen to psychiatrists. Psychiatrists should be in every parliament and should direct and monitor political activities.
Very interesting, because this is a topic discussed at length by Paul Gottfried in his classic book, After Liberalism, and in the subsequent, in the follow-up, Multiculturalism, and what was the subtitle of that book? Anyway, it's called Multiculturalism and something. And he talks about the therapeutic state and how this has become a kind of dominant mode of thinking within liberalism, that the individual person, the individual subject of the state, needs to have their behavior modified and altered. And if you spend time reading official government documents, as I sometimes do, and I have done in the past for research, they now openly talk in terms of behavior modification and behavioral change. British government does. You know, they want people to conform to a certain way of behaving. Pretty scary stuff. And look, they were doing it right here in the 1930s.
Because they knew, in a rational, scientific way, what was good for people.
Cameron had been an advisor to the judges at the Nuremberg trials. The experience convinced him that the bitter rivalries of nationalism, which had led to the war, had to be eradicated. Nationalism, he thought, existed only in people's minds as distorted historical memories. If those memories could somehow be altered, one could produce a rational world, free of war.
Right. Come on, line up, lads. Karl, Morgoth, all of you, all of you, Horus from last week, all of you with your naughty nationalistic thoughts, I want to line you all up. It's time to have your brains altered.
What Cameron thought was that man was not, mankind was not inherently evil. When he came back from Nuremberg trial, where he was an expert, he could see that what had happened with prejudice and nationalism leading to World War I and II, he thought that should never happen again. And he hoped that nationalism could be wiped out. People would forget about it. They would remake people.
Cameron founded the Allen Memorial Institute in a Gothic mansion overlooking Montreal. It was both a psychiatric clinic and a centre for research. His aim was to find ways of changing the memories in the minds of his mentally ill patients.
And she said, "You have used me as a fish long enough. You know, I feel."
She has used you as a fish?
You know, she spoke like that. Not me, but she was talking to her partner who was recording everything from every room, even the cafeteria.
We were looking upon memory as a pattern of circuits in the brain, which had got deal.
This, what we're watching here, is some proper Arkham Asylum shit right here. I mean, this is probably the darkest thing Curtis has touched so far. Bloody hell. And note, it's a corrective against nationalism after World War II.
Arranged. And if we could change that, if it was a memory which was a sick memory and it could be got rid of and replaced with a healthy memory or a healthy pattern of memories, then he might get success even with neurotic patients.
Then, 3,000 miles away, a series of grand historical events began to unfold. They would give Cameron the chance to pursue his dream.
As a shadow had fallen upon the scenes so lately lighted by the Allied victory. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the...
Thanks, Winston. Thanks. Somehow, an iron curtain has descended there in the ashes of the quote-unquote Allied victory. Who done that, I wonder? Twat.
As the Cold War began, memory became a weapon in the confrontation between Russia and America. A stream of refugees from the Eastern Bloc began to arrive in the Allied sectors in Germany. To American intelligence agents, the knowledge these people carried with them was critical. America knew nothing of the Soviet Union.
Well, the reason memory became important in the Cold War, because we were seeking information, and all information is based on memory. When I talk to a Soviet defector, and I'm talking back in the days of the Cold War, I want to know everything that he remembers. Human memory, in the absence of documentary information, was your only source of intelligence, because this person might have information in his memory that may be exploitable for our purposes.
But the CIA began to fear that the Soviets had found
dishonest chin, dishonest nose,
found a way of controlling human memory. As in the show trials of the 1930s, they seemed to be able to program people to behave like automatons. The idea that it might be possible to manipulate memory gripped the imagination of those in power in America.
Yet!
The Soviet secret police and their offspring in Eastern Europe and China have presented the world with a series of public trials at which prisoners, including some Americans, calmly and apparently without coercion, made confessions of unbelievable crimes, espionage, sabotage, treason. To Western observers, these confessions have been so bewildering that a belief has grown that the communists have perfected some mysterious, irresistible technique for manipulating human behavior.
What worried the CIA most was the behavior of American prisoners in the Korean War. 70% of those held by the Chinese made elaborate confessions or signed petitions against the war. An alarming number stuck by their confessions when released.
Were they using drugs? Were they using hypnosis? There was great anxiety to really focus and see, is this possible? Because there was this feeling that the Soviets in particular were developing devious techniques in which they could influence the human mind.
I'll just note that the crazy doctor with his Arkham Asylum was in Toronto. He wasn't in China. It's weird, isn't it? It's like they do this dark stuff themselves. They're aware of it, and then they're convinced the enemy is doing it as well. So they need to go one worse. That's how the logic of these things often plays out, where both sides are paranoid. So they kind of try to out dystopia each other. I'm actually surprised that Curtis revealed this to millions of people on BBC One or never in 1992. But let's carry on.
And that they were dangerous because of what kinds of things were they doing to affect the mind.
That's Bobby Lembeck.
Sorry, it was Montreal, not Toronto. Not that it makes much difference, but it was somewhere in Canada.
Our mascot, I guess you'd call him.
Doesn't look old enough to be in your army.
I guess he isn't, but there he is, ma'am.
Captain Marco, will you be good enough to lend Raymond your pistol, please?
Yes, ma'am.
Thanks, Beth.
Sure, kid.
Shoot Bobby Raymond. Through the forehead.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, fucking hell.
A group of CIA psychologists.
Fucking hell. Curtis has not held back in this documentary. This is probably going to get an age stamp, folks. You might as well watch it live. This has been extreme.
Traveled to Montreal. They wanted to meet Dr. Cameron. He had published a paper about his work called Brainwashing Canadian Style. He too was fascinated by what had happened to the American prisoners.
Cameron was particularly interested to find out how these people could have changed their minds so radically. What was the method that the Chinese used or the Russians used? And whether he could use similar methods to bring about therapeutic change in some of these neurotic patients.
Ma femme est Madame Legrand.
Cameron had begun a series of experiments to try and brainwash the memories in his patients. He called it psychic driving. he had been inspired by the best-selling gadget of 1953, the Dormaphone.
My friends, you'll recall that a week ago we enrolled that young man in Slumber College because of Miss Tony Monahan of Holyoke, Massachusetts. Wanted to know if a person could really learn in their sleep. Now, the sleep teaching technique is based on findings that the brain is capable of absorbing information while we sleep. The instrument used is the Dormaphone.
His method of what he called psychic driving was a persuasive message on tape, which was repeated and repeated over again.
So one of the things I've been thinking about, because Curtis is obsessed with this little period here, just after World War One in the World War Two in the 1950s, when science looked kind of crazy and scary like this. But just think now, right? Every single one of us, or most of you watching this, has got an iPad or an iPhone or an Alexa in the corner, or all of these little gadgets that we've allowed into our lives. And, you know, if they were thinking this way back in 1950, I can't help but wonder if these basically military-backed technologies that have been unleashed on the populations don't subtly alter the way people think and behave. It has been known that they use gamified techniques to keep people basically addicted to these devices today. And the reason I'm saying this is that I don't want people to think, oh, that was back then, and now everything's nice and safe. We'd never let anything as scary as that device into our homes today. I actually think, if anything, it's worse today than it was in the 1950s. And I just thought it was worth saying that. Not saying I'm bad, you know, I need to really, one of the things I'd love to do is get rid of my mobile phone. I've been thinking, this mobile phone I've got, once it's conked out, maybe I'll just never replace it. And I'm thinking more and more along these lines, because I do think that these machines that we allow into our lives end up controlling our lives and rewiring the way we think and behave and go about our lives. So anyway, let's continue.
To the patient, sometimes when they're asleep, sometimes when they're awake. We even had people walking around with these American football helmets with earphones in, and they were listening to the message all the time. The message would be, people like me, I'm popular, people like to be with me and enjoy my company. He was trying to obliterate the sick memories.
And here is our subject here. This is Mr. Bill Franklin, Professor Miller.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Bonjour, monsieur.
Maintenant, répondez à ces questions. Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Voici un phonographe.
Qu'est-ce que c'est?
Voici un disque.
Comment vous appelez-vous?
Bill Franklin.
The CIA decided to fund Cameron's experiments. They wanted to find a way of controlling human beings by reprogramming their memories. The CIA was convinced that the Russians already knew how to do this. What they feared most was that Soviet agents with false memories could infiltrate America. They would be immune to lie detector or to truth drug. They could be programmed to rise high in American society. They might even infiltrate the CIA.
People feared that it might be possible to clone or develop a person, you know, where he could rise to a high position in the American service while really secretly following the guidance of a foreign power.
I mean, do you even need to when you've got guys like Joe Biden? But this has been a hard-hitting one today.
Because you have developed his memory to the point where his brain could carry two entirely different roles.
You talk to him. What do you think?
It's him. He's your Uncle Ira, all right?
He is not.
How is he different?
That's just it. There is no difference you can actually see. He looks, sounds, acts, and remembers like Uncle Ira.
Then he is your Uncle Ira. Can't you see that? No matter how you feel, he is.
But he isn't. There's something missing.
You can create memories that never were. And if you create memories that never existed, then you're creating an aspect of behavior that is now implanted. In other words, what I'm saying is that you can implant memories. Memories are potent sources of motivated behavior. If you implant enough memories of specific kinds, you can shape and change the nature of human thinking and feelings.
What about memories? There must be...
Fucking dark shit, this. I mean, my mind immediately went to a lot of the... you know, there were various epidemics of people claiming that they'd been abused as children. This was a big thing. I can't remember if it was in the 80s or the 90s, possibly even the 70s. But I remember reading about it once, where literally thousands of kids claimed they'd been abused when they had not been. And those memories had basically been implanted, or they were false. They were false memories, but they were totally believed by the kids. Can't remember the name of the study now that was done on it, but that was a well-known phenomenon of this. But yeah, very, very interesting. I mean, I kind of feel like the whole the entirety of what I call the Boomer Truth regime is a kind of false memory too. But anyway, let's carry on.
Be certain things that only you and he would know about.
Oh God, I've talked to him about them. He remembers them all down to the last small detail, just like Uncle Ira would. But Miles, there's no emotion. None. Memories or not, he isn't my Uncle Ira.
Wilma, I'm on your side. My business is people in trouble, and I'm going to find a way to help you. I want you to realize that. Think about it. And then you'll know that the trouble is inside you.
Wilma, where are you? Out on the lawn.
Agents from the CIA began to travel regularly to Montreal. They were disguised as representatives of a scientific institute. It was called the Society for the Investigation of Human Ecology.
One of the techniques that Curtis is using in this particular documentary, by the way, let's talk about his craft for a second. He's using a lot of what they call contrapuntal sound, where if this was a kind of jobbing hack director putting this together, like a kind of normie BBC documentary maker, they would have made the music sinister, right? Whereas consistently, Curtis, throughout this, he's been showing us like literally people going under, you know, having their brains prodded by scary looking doctors, and he's playing jaunty jazz under it, and he's been doing that consistently throughout this documentary. But the technique is called contrapuntal sound, or at least that's what I was taught in university years ago.
Money allowed Dr. Cameron to push his experiments much further. He began to work on ways of completely wiping the memory of human beings.
Just for a fraction of a second, the patient doesn't feel it.
He was really using it to try and... change the fundamental function of the individual, to alter their past memories, their past ways of behaving, and as I think he said at one point, it is to just sort of erase everything from their past, so that you then had a slate in which you could record new ways of behavior. And so he used massive doses of shock, of people receiving several shocks a day, and over a course of time, hundreds of ECT treatments, so that they were just reduced to a sort of a very primitive vegetable state.
Cameron was trying to fulfill...
It's fucking mental. This is crazy.
...fulfill his dream. The patients brought to him would be transformed into new human beings, freed from their troubled past.
The door has
bang shut behind me. I don't know when I'm going to see you again with my healthy eyes. The car could not stop when I asked for it. We went on and on.
Do you know the CIA should have been shut down at this point when the president was told, yeah, listen, Mr. President, we're just giving people like massive doses of electric shocks and reducing them to have vegetables in a bid to reprogram them as new human beings. The president at that point should have said, right, I'm shutting this shit down. This is like, you guys, you've already lost the plot, and it's only 1947. You know, who knows what these fuckers are up to now?
I don't remember what happened to me. I was introduced to Dr. Cameron, and I don't remember Dr. Cameron at all. I was diagnosed schizophrenic. I found that out by reading my file 20 years later. I don't remember any of that. They shipped me up to what they called the sleep room, and they gave me all of these electroconvulsive shock treatments and mega doses of drugs and LSD and all of that, and I have no memory of any of that. Nothing of that time in the Allen Memorial or any of my life previous to that. All gone. Wiped.
Linda McDonald was brought to the Allen Institute by her family. She was 26 and suffered severe depression. Cameron began treating her with what he called depatterning. She was kept asleep for 20 out of 24 hours.
With the depatterning process, the person would descend in their memory further and further back.
I mean, the obvious question to ask is, what this guy here, right? What? How is he not in jail? How is he not in jail? That's why he shouldn't be telling us this on a documentary. He should be in jail.
With the depatterning process, the person would descend in their memory further and further back. So they'd go back in time to before they got sick. That was the important thing, it seemed to be, before they got sick.
And then having depatterned somebody or brought them down to where basically nothing but the essential functions of the body were going on in terms of breathing and things of this nature, that then he would begin to feed material into these individuals, positive material, such that the brain would be programmed in a positive way, so that the individual would be completely altered.
Then he put these tapes under our pillows called psychic driving. He would then put back into this empty brain a program of whatever sort he decided upon, and the people like myself would wake up another person, I guess.
Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories, and you're reborn into an untroubled world.
Honestly, the stuff that Kurtz has shown here is darker than anything that happens in 1984 or most of the dystopian fictions I can think of. Like, the truth was more horrific. What the fuck is this?
Where everyone's the same. Exactly. What a world. We're not the last humans left. They'll destroy you. Tomorrow you won't want them to. Tomorrow you'll be one of us. I don't want any part of it. You're forgetting something, Miles. What's that? You have no choice.
When I was discharged from the Allen Memorial, I felt like an alien from another world visiting this world. I didn't fit. I was watching myself cooking, taking care of the children, doing the washing. But I knew I was different, and I didn't know how to become like everybody else. And it was a very lonely, scary place to be.
People told me they were my children, but that didn't mean anything to me, so they were little people. They had names, and they smiled, and they went to school.
You really had no memory of them?
No, no, none whatsoever. Or of their father, whom I had married when I was 18, and I'd known for most of my life. It was, this is your husband. What's husband? What's making love?
You are hearing electrical impulses from artificial neurons, an attempt to duplicate the behavior of living nerves with electronic parts. This is how the higher nervous system, a man's brain, might work as a machine.
Cameron's experiments were extraordinary in their ambition, but they were not the work of a maverick. He was part of a new scientific way of thinking about the human mind that grew up in the 1950s. The brain, scientists believed, was like a computer, and memory was information.
The image of the mind that became dominant was essentially a very fast and a very clever computer, such that memory was information that you had inscribed in specific places where you, you know, were then accessible for retrieval.
See, I feel they still think in this way. I read a lot of Cog for a couple of books I wrote when I was a bit younger. I read a lot of stuff on cognition and how the mind works, and the analogies they used were all basically computer based, or like I'd often see them described as CPU processing and data storage, and that they'd often use those as analogies to explain what the hell they were talking about, you know. So maybe that tendency has not gone away.
And you could get rid of them, add them. And in many ways, history was being regarded in the same way. I mean, in the Soviet state, for example, you airbrushed memory, and that was it, and was not, no longer in the picture.
In the 1950s, a new science of the mind grew up in America's universities. It was called cognitive science, and it linked psychology, psychiatry, and neuroscience. The image of the brain was that of a computer. It was an image that fitted perfectly with the political needs of those who were running the Cold War.
The image of...
I will say, though, that that doesn't, like... There's a suggestion in what Curtis is saying that the human mind's not really like a computer. But there is... If you consider that computers are human-made and that humans design computers and made computers in their own image, you could argue that maybe the computer is modeled after the human brain, and therefore it does have a resemblance. But maybe I'm only saying that because all of the books on cognition I read described it like a computer. I don't know, but there could be something to it, you know.
The human being that was being built up at that particular time was that there was a great deal of vulnerability in every human being, and that vulnerability could be manipulated to program somebody to be something that I wanted them to be and they didn't want to be. That you could manipulate people in such a way that they could be automatons, if you will, for whatever your own purposes were. This was the image that people thought was possible.
Yeah. I just feel like I don't have any thoughts like a human being. I'm just an animal walking around on the earth.
In some experiments, the behavior of mentally ill patients was directly altered by wires planted inside the brain.
I'm not saying the human brain is literally like a computer. People in the chat are freaking out a bit. What I'm saying is that there are processes that happen within the way people think. For example, right, in a computer you've got RAM and you've got the data storage, okay, and the RAM is the stuff that your computer's accessing right now, whereas the stuff in storage, you know, is just sitting there waiting for you to access it or whatever. My understanding of memory is that it's the way it's described in a lot of the literature. It is similar, that you have long-term memories, and then you have things that you have short-term memory, almost like your, you know, you have the, what do they, how do they describe it? Like cognitive function stuff that, you know, stuff that your RAM is doing on a day-to-day basis. They were saying that, I'm trying to remember it now because it's been probably about 10 years since I read a lot of this stuff. But for example, right, some things are mentally taxing. So imagine you had to do a reasonably complex sum, right? So most people, if you said, what is 6 plus 5? They could tell you it was 11 without even thinking, right? You just know that automatically. But if it's something a little bit more complicated, like, I don't know, 78 times 92, let's just say, most people can't do that mentally, quickly. They'd have to stop and think about it. And apparently, if you're walking, let's say you're walking along a street, it's meant to be so mentally taxing to do that sum that you will actually physically stop. You'll actually stop in your tracks to do it because it's taking up that, it's that taxing, if that makes any sense. And there is a name given to that cognitive load when you're thinking, okay? And if you read the literature, it is described a little bit like your RAM capacity in a computer, how quickly you can do something that complex, that complicated. Anyway, let's carry on. So it's not identical. I'm just saying that there are analogous functions in how people think, and that's probably why the writers of all these books use those analogies so often.
I would go off somewhere, not never see nobody.
Now the treatment is started. She's receiving a very minute amount of current. Actually, it amounts to only 5/1000ths of an ampere, delivered to a very specific region in the brain. And, of course, it's changing in behavior.
Now look at that smile you got now.
Why does that make me do that? I don't like to do that.
You really told me off, remember?
I know I did, but I couldn't help it.
The CIA was deeply involved in the growth of cognitive science. Dr. Cameron was only one of many scientists whose work was funded by the agency in the 50s.
The CIA tended to be involved with those scientists and researchers who were on the frontiers of brain research, and they tended to choose them as young scientists and support them and subsidize them so their work would continue in the areas that the CIA found interesting. You've got to understand that it wasn't just one or two individuals, but that the CIA funded perhaps 15 or 20 key people right across the fields of psychology and brain research. So one can make a real case that the CIA played a catalytic role in the development of psychology as we know it today, and as it was born in the 1950s and early 1960s.
Thanks, CIA. You know, in the dark shit division, That's where the CIA made their greatest contributions, in the, you know, the forbidden chapter of dark shit that isn't in the standard textbook.
The psychologists who did agree to help you?
Well, some of them don't want to be identified, so I won't really answer that question for you.
Why do they not want their names mentioned?
Because they like to deny they ever had anything to do with the Central Intelligence Agency. After we got our bad name and became a rogue tiger, and the peace movements and everything that came in terms of that began to bloody the nose of CIA. And certainly many of the professors in the universities and in the various laboratories in terms of that, it was embarrassing for them.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be, if I was involved in doing like basically sci-fi level reprogrammings of people, giving them electric shock therapy, literal Clockwork Orange style reconditioning, I'd probably be embarrassed to admit that to people as well. Because people would rightly want to put me in jail.
To have to admit that they worked for CIA. Now, that That's a fact. I shouldn't have said that, but that's a fact.
But they were, but back in those days, they were happy to work for you.
Very, very much so, and very interested.
It wasn't only human beings who became involved with the experiments. Animals, too, were programmed to fight the Cold War. One project was codenamed Acoustic Kitty.
The idea behind Acoustic Kitty was to develop an audio device that could function despite extraneous noises. The cat that was used for the experiment had to be cut open and have a power pack placed inside its abdomen. Wires were run up to its ear, to its cochlea, wires to its brain to determine when it was hungry or sexually aroused, and wires to override these urges. The cat was then put on a test, sent across the street to eavesdrop on a conversation, being monitored by a van loaded with equipment.
How is this fucking real? How, I mean, this is just...
And as this poor little monstrosity waddled across the street, a taxi cab came down and ran it over. It was $25 million down the drain. $25 million was a lot of money then.
Good hell.
Moscow is in the midst of the last hours of summer.
Then suddenly, the Soviet threat came much closer to America. In 1960, the new president of Cuba, Fidel Castro, announced a formal alliance with the Soviet Union. America was in the midst of a presidential election, and Cuba became one of the central issues.
Cuba has been lost, for the time being, to the communists. And I want Mr. Khrushchev and anyone else to understand that if the Democratic Party wins this election, he will confront in the 1960s an America which is not only militarily strong, but which is waging the offensive for freedom all around the globe.
He had an obsession then about, I've got to get Castro. And he pushed us, and his brother Bobby did too, every day, harder and harder, running those covert operations to try to get Castro.
He was, in our view, a bad man, the head of a government that we wanted to destabilize. And as part of that destabilization program, we set out to assassinate him.
Those in the sea.
Makes me sad to see all of this work making my cigars more expensive as a result. Thanks, JFK. Got himself a lifetime supply of upmans while he was at it, though.
The CIA, who ran the psychological experiments, were given the task of finding ways to assassinate Castro. So they returned to Montreal. They hoped that Cameron's repatterning might allow them to program a perfect, undetectable assassin. But what they didn't know was that Cameron's experiments weren't working out quite as he had expected.
He was saying to the world, I have developed a program in which I can literally alter the behavior of people so that they will be well and able to function in society, make a contribution to the society, be happy, as opposed to before the treatment, they were just not able to cope at all. And it just wasn't there in the data. It just wasn't true.
But Cameron was determined to prove that his methods were working. He made films which demonstrated that his patients, whose memories...
This guy Cameron is stark raving mad. This is like every horror film you've ever seen, you know. Igor! Igor! Yes, my master! I mean, this is fucking mental, this stuff.
...had been reconstructed were better.
To provide an objective record of a subject's behavior, she's filmed before treatment and again after treatment, and the two films placed side by side. Notice how the subject before treatment, in the picture on the right, holds onto the chair as she moves. Notice the difference in posture, the greater effort required to rise from the chair, the longer time needed to complete the simple task.
Cameron was producing a new sort of human being, but not the kind he had predicted. He had succeeded brilliantly in wiping the memories of his patients, but he couldn't find a way of replacing them with new memories. His patients were completely free of their past and of all the emotions that went with it.
I don't even have any kind of emotional memory. My first memories are just of being. And I had to learn how to be a social creature, and that was the most difficult.
I mean, all right, he didn't manage to program the new memories, but he achieved Men in Black, is what we're saying. He did Men in Black, this guy. Fucking hell. I wonder if they secretly still use any of this technology.
It wasn't learning how to drive the car or learning how to cook. It was learning how to communicate with you people, because you talk and on many different levels. There's hidden agendas and innuendo and just about everything that a lot of people say. Memory is wrapped in what society has decided we should feel like. You should cry at funerals. I found myself not crying at a funeral, and I felt just fine. And I thought, gee, there's something the matter with me. I'm not crying. I should cry. Everybody else is crying.
Funny enough, I feel like that at funerals too. But I didn't go to Dr. Cameron's crazy lab. Maybe it's just me.
But there wasn't that need to.
Why is all of this being done? What have they built you to do?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows except Beretsovo in Moscow and my American operator here. Or whatever it is, it's supposed to happen soon. Right at the convention. Maybe. I don't know. They can make me do anything, Ben. Can't they? Anything.
The CIA were terrified that the Russians might also be working to produce a programmed assassin. They decided to continue funding Dr. Cameron. Whether he was creating healthy human beings or not was now irrelevant. The perfect assassin would be programmed for one simple task, and the fewer memories and emotions involved, the better.
A perfect agent would be somebody conditioned to be kind of amoral. You could train them to use firearms indiscriminately. You could train them to shoot people with very little feeling or thought. You could train them to use abusive and brutalizing procedures in order to obtain information with no hesitancy, with no concern. For example, I might not easily be able to go into a laboratory, take a knife, and cut a cat's head off. It's something that I would find very difficult to do.
Now, this is explaining that Kirby guy who's in the current government. He gives me these vibes. Because I can imagine him doing that and not caring at all.
In order to achieve that, you would have to deal with significant aspects of memory.
Not having a memory is not knowing who you are, and not having any sense of how to fit into the world. I didn't know it was not right to flirt at parties if you're a married person. I carried a dictionary with me for 5 years and would run into strangers' kitchens at parties trying to look up the words and trying to figure out what it was that was going on in the living room so that I could take part in it, because I wanted to. I wanted to be just like everybody else, and I knew I wasn't. I didn't know what the script was. I didn't know what the next cue was going to be. I didn't know who the actors were. I didn't know what the plot was. I didn't know what the end of the play was going to be. And it was very, very scary.
Well, what happened to this Dr. Cameron guy? Surely he has to go to jail, doesn't he? I mean, they talk about bloody, the Nazi angel of death, Mengele, and all of that. This guy is insane.
The assassination of President Kennedy began to tear the CIA apart. Some within the organization believed that Lee Harvey Oswald had been trained by the Soviet Union to kill the president. Others feared that it was the result of their own assassination program that somehow had gone horribly wrong. Either way, those who interrogated Oswald became convinced he had not acted alone. Someone else seemed to be in control of his behavior and his mind.
I was amazed that a person so young would have the self-control that he had. It was almost as if he had anticipated the situation. It was almost as if he had been rehearsed or programmed to meet the situation that he found himself in. It was almost as if he anticipated every question, every suggestion, every move that any of the people in charge of him...
Is Curtis seriously suggesting that the killer of JFK was one of these psychos, CIA-trained, mind-reprogrammed psychos? Is he really suggesting this?
Made.
Rehearsed by whom?
Who knows?
Have anything to say in your defense? Oswald has a shot!
4 years before he shot President Kennedy, Oswald had defected to the Soviet Union. To many, this was proof he was a Soviet agent. But 2 months after his death, a KGB agent defected to America. His name was Yuri Nosenko. He told the CIA that his job had been to watch Oswald in Russia. He assured them that Oswald had never been trained by the KGB. It was the beginning of paranoia inside the CIA. Some senior officers refused to believe Nosenko. They had another KGB defector called...
Tell you what, it's like... I mean, this is episode 12 of Reviewing Adam Curtis. It's like he was driving in first and second gear, you know, for every single other one he's done, maybe up to third last time. This one, he's just been like, oh, fuck it, let's get into sixth and cruise on 120 miles an hour. This has been insane, this documentary. Compared to all the other ones we've seen, this is like a next gear, for sure.
Anatoly Golitsyn. He told them that Nosenko was false. He had been sent by the KGB to trick them.
Nosenko is the key, because Nosenko handled Harvey Lee Oswald in Russia for the KGB. Mr. Golitsyn says that Nosenko is a Soviet plant to mislead American intelligence. So when Nosenko says that Oswald was not acting on behalf of the KGB, that means that, in fact, Oswald was acting on behalf of the KGB. And there you go, and you are in the wilderness of mirrors. You see everything, and in fact, you see nothing.
Nosenko was held in complete isolation by the CIA and interrogated day and night, but he stuck to his story. But those in charge of his interrogation did not believe him. They were convinced he had been implanted with false memories by the KGB.
Nosenko's brain is the depository of the truth. Whatever the truth is in his memory, is in his brain. And the thing is to find a key which will open that brain so we can find the true memory from the false memory.
The CIA set out to wipe Nosenko's false memories.
This is fucking mental. See, the thing is because they were doing this stuff themselves, they just assumed that the other guys were doing it. And that they used that as the logic to do it in the first place. It's kind of something about this extremely paranoid way of thinking that leads to bizarre scenarios like this now.
They used all the techniques that Dr. Cameron had taught them.
The problem of detecting whether or not a memory that has been implanted can be uncovered and revealed to be a false memory involves great risks because you have to break through the amnesia and you have to force the individual to confront the conflict of that experience, which can lead to abreactions, disorientation, confusion, and sometimes actual mental illness. I mean, he might be a basket case.
One drug affected me very strong. I simply was floating. I was almost half conscious. And suddenly, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't take air in, couldn't take air out. Almost died. They noticed on TV camera, they ran, immediately pulled me out of cell. And next door, it was my shower stall and bathroom facilities. They put me under shower, cold water, hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, to bring me.
Lysenko was kept in complete isolation for 3 years. Oh. The Americans tried every possible technique to break into his memory, but all of them failed. The CIA was torn apart by his case. Those who believed him were themselves accused of being under Soviet control.
The CIA needs to be shut down. I mean, I know people say it really does need to be just shut down. How can this pillar of just absolute evil be allowed to exist at the heart of the American government? It's disgusting.
Dr. Cameron had set out to free human beings from their past. His experiments ended in a dark world of paranoia. There was no way of telling whether a person's memory was true or false. No one could be trusted.
We had been really chasing a phantom, if you will, an illusion, that the human mind was more capable of manipulation from the outside, by outside.
I mean, look at this guy, right? Look at this guy. Dr. Chief Gittinger, CIA chief psychologist from 1950 to 1974. I mean, he might as well be called head of exceptionally dark shit, should be in jail. But yet, I mean, this has been mind-blowing. It really has been.
Manipulation from the outside, by outside factors than it is.
The CIA had pursued the psychological experiments for one simple reason. They had been convinced the Soviets were doing the same thing. But the KGB had long ago given up trying to use psychology. They had found another way of predicting the behavior of human beings.
To my mind, practically, psychology isn't developed enough to make the practical conclusions. When I started to work as an intelligence officer, I was asked by my chief.
Now, here's a question. The other dude was called Yuri. We all know Yuri Bezmenov. This guy is called Yuri. Why is every single KGB officer called Yuri? Can anybody tell me that? Any Russian tell me that? Is it like a, not a name, but like a rank or something? Why are they all called Yuri?
And do you know what he asked me first? He asked me whether I read Dostoevsky. And in his opinion, you've got to know the psychological problems in the way they've been described by Dostoevsky. He said that Dostoevsky would let me understand people, would let me see what is happening in his head. Dostoevsky would help me to see the reasons for his actions.
I just love this idea. Psychopathic American CIA doing all this dark shit and the Russians are literally just reading Dostoevsky. Get out, Swan Lake.
Do you think the Americans should have read Dostoevsky? The CIA?
They do it. As far as I know, they do it. They studied Dostoevsky.
That was based.
The CIA stopped all funding of psychological research, and Dr. Cameron turned to study the memory of a simpler organism, the flatworm.
Oh.
But the dream of creating a controllable mind that could be programmed was far from over. It was about to take a strange new twist. Cognitive science...
Does anyone ever guess what happens next? Dr. Cameron programmed an army of psychopathic flatworms, maybe.
Came up with a new idea. If it was impossible to make the human mind behave like a machine, the alternative was to make a machine with a mind of its own. Scientists now began to build intelligent machines with memories that could be programmed. They taught them to recognize and to understand the world around them. The scientists were inspired by the same underlying belief that had driven the experiments of the 1950s, that the mind and the computer were identical. But they were going to push this idea much further.
A lot of people thought that the mind was in some respects like a computer. But there were others, they insisted something much more radical, which was that the mind is a computer, and the only good psychological theory is a computer program, because basically there's just a computer in the head. It was a heady idea for them. They had the notion that very soon, using these new computer techniques and ideas, they would be able to simulate the processes on the computer. And when people are that confident, they are good salesmen for their ideas. And a lot of people bought it.
At this very same moment, the Cold War also changed direction. It was no longer fought out by human agents. It became instead a war of machines. Both sides now possessed enough nuclear missiles for what was called mutual assured destruction, or MAD.
Incidentally, by the way, this topic is very topical right now. I made a tweet yesterday talking about why it is that all of the countries of the world are acting as if nukes aren't real, and that the logic of MAD seems to have flipped around, whereby in the Cold War, nobody attacked each other because of the threat of nuclear apocalypse. In the current climate, you get Iran and Israel attacking each other, America provoking Russia, politicians, Lindsey Graham, etc., openly calling for nuclear war, Putin coming out and saying, yeah, I've got nukes, by the way. Nobody is acting as if they're real. And I'm very interested in this topic because it's something that I discussed for many hours at the last event, the WITAN with Panama Hat. We stayed up all night smoking cigars and discussing the logic of you know, the prospects of nuclear war. And apparently, Praise of Folly, who's a buddy of mine, is doing a show tomorrow called "Quote Unquote Nukes Aren't Real," where he's going to be looking at this more. And if anybody else knows of anything else on this particular topic right now, I'm currently interested in it because something's happened recently. I want to know why the governments of the world don't seem to be worried about impending nuclear apocalypse when we seem to be pretty bloody close to nuclear war. So anyway, let's carry on.
The fear was that the slightest mistake could lead to all-out war. To those in charge of America's defense, the idea of intelligent machines was extremely attractive. Their memories would be completely controllable. Unlike human beings, they would not make mistakes.
Artificial intelligence emerged at the point at which there was the immediate worry of a war, some kind of a rationally breaking out war, and that maybe this was some way of helping to control the situation. So there was a lot of magic thinking, I think, that was set loose by the concept of artificial intelligence, that we would have a wonderful kind of control, a big brother control kind of thing. And it was always a tempting one. It wasn't quite a mean Orwellian one. It was like the people in Orwell, they thought it would be great. Things would be looked after. And scientists, you have to understand, always go the easy route.
Once again, cognitive science became caught up in the political pressures of the Cold War. The Department of Defense, through its research...
You see, this is the thing. Watching these documentaries, it gives you the idea that all of this is in the past, but they haven't stopped doing any of this shit. And it is right now in 2024, it is right up in our face. You know, people call it AI and transhumanism and all these new terms now. It's exactly the same thinking as all of this, just with updated technology.
Research agency, ARPA, offered to fund the whole of the new discipline of artificial intelligence. In return, the scientists' work would be used to build intelligent weapons. The source of this funding was kept very quiet. The scientists were embarrassed. They didn't want the public to find out what their real job was.
You have to remember that ARPA's funding of artificial intelligence was for military purposes, but many of the people in that community come from liberal intellectual institutions. They particularly are not interested in military objectives. And so ARPA has...
This is just the same as saying, listen, I'm not professor of the dark arts. I am not responsible for dark shit. I am a professor of nice things and fluffy and good things. That's all this is saying, really. You know, they just didn't want to admit that they were doing evil shit. I wouldn't want to admit that to normal people either. Not that I would ever do any evil stuff, of course.
I've always been very good at being able to marshal those forces and to trick them or lead them or move them in directions that have significant military benefits. It had an explicit goal of transitioning this technology into the military-industrial complex.
How do you trick these researchers, these scientists?
You lead them in directions that are useful militarily without explicitly asking them to think about the applications. So we'd say to them, let's work on TV image processing. And they would get results that would be applicable to processing of imagery for military purposes.
So, pitch. Ready. Execute.
During the 1970s, a completely new type of weapon was developed in America. Intelligent missiles with memories that could be programmed. The most famous was the cruise missile, which had a picture of its target stored in its memory. These weapons were a direct product of the science of artificial intelligence. They fundamentally altered the balance of power in the Cold War. In return, artificial intelligence became a powerful science. The idea that human beings and computers were identical came to dominate not just scientific thinking, but popular culture too.
Another brilliant Curtis sequence, this, by the way.
And I'd like to grab inside your head for a minute and haul it over here and down here for a minute, where I've got some friends gathered at something called the Cyber.
Breathlessly enthusiastic television programs were made. They portrayed the artificial intelligence scientists as heroic figures.
People often ask if there will ever be machines that think. Well, we ourselves are machines that think by using great computers in our brains. And someday we will know enough to build machines that do such things and more.
No mention was made of the fact that Marvin Minsky had already built a thinking machine. His work had helped to create the memory of the cruise missile.
One of the most interesting things about the history of artificial intelligence is that the public was engaged in a kind of gee whiz perception of artificial intelligence as the quest for a thinking machine, when in fact what was really happening behind the scenes and out of the view of the public was this development of very dangerous, really revolutionary weapon systems that had the potential for changing the nature of war. And it was that was the primary focus of the funding agency that was providing almost all the money for artificial intelligence research. And this was almost never mentioned in the general press coverage of this particular field.
Does anyone believe that Elon Musk today is not connected to all of this? That he's like genuinely this kind of maverick billionaire that's just allowed to spout off and do what he wants? Strikes me as, watching this, it strikes me as far-fetched. This was 1995, this documentary, I believe. So that bloke you saw talking there was, what, 30 years ago? In 30 years, this apparatus just allowed one South African dude to do all of that. Does that strike you as plausible, likely. Anyway, let's carry on. I'm just asking the question.
And I want to build myself into a machine that lives forever.
We are at 1625:47 on the 23rd of February, literally 4:25 in the afternoon. And Eagle Troop has just penetrated the main Iraqi defenses. What we're seeing here is a simulation of an actual battle that occurred during the war with Iraq, recreated by ARPA. And the events that you're seeing here are as they were reported by the soldiers who took part in the battle. And it represents literally a giant composite memory of all of the individuals who participated in the battle, as well as a variety of experts who had the opportunity to study the battle after it occurred.
The Gulf War can be viewed as an absolutely tailor-made testing ground for a lot of DARPA ideas and systems. Since we had an environment that was basically flat, it was like a laboratory in the sense that it gave the military supporters of AI a tailor-made situation in which they could prove their case with systems that could remove personnel from harm's way.
We are not in the business of destroying Kuwait while we are liberating Kuwait. And we certainly didn't want to go in and completely destroy the oil field or do undue damage. Now, what you're seeing here is that's the manifold area, the very small area that I talked about. And you're looking right through the nose of the guided munition as it's flown straight into the small manifold area to destroy it.
The Gulf War was a triumph for those who had developed intelligent weapons. Much of the conflict was fought by machines. It was a war without personal, painful memories. The deaths and destruction on the Iraqi side were witnessed only by the machines and a few soldiers. When those soldiers returned, they found that their memories were different from the public perception of the war.
When I came back from the war, I talked to those people who were not there, and their memory, at least to me, was completely different than what I had experienced. Their memory was a long-distance, very clean, very precise video game war where you put the X on the target, you shoot the bomb from 10 miles away, and you go home and you have a soda or a beer or whatnot. And that's not how I recall it, okay? For us, it was a lot of blood, sweat, tears, fear, anxiety. And it was. When you came back, there was two completely different perceptions of what had happened. It almost made it too simple. It almost made it without pain, without suffering, without blood.
The scientists who had begun the experiments on human memory 40 years before dreamt of freeing people from the memory of terrible events.
Can I just say that is still the perception of war of a lot of people in the West, and in America in particular. Those NAFO guys, you know, I see it every single time when we discuss geopolitical stuff, when it was the Iran versus Israel a couple of weeks back. There'll always be somebody in the chat whose perception of war is exactly like that soldier just described, as a kind of video game, long distance, you know, clean, go back to the barbecue, etc. A lot of people still think that. So it's a very powerful narrative or myth, if you want.
Past. Those who had designed the machines that fought the Gulf War had finally achieved just that. The detailed record of the terrible and brutal events are contained not in human minds, but in a giant computer built by ARPA. Every gunshot and every death can be played back from any position.
The easiest way to think of this, literally, is that we're on a magic carpet and we can travel freely throughout the database and observe the events that are occurring as they occurred at that point in time. What this record represents is a ground truth of the events as they occurred on this given day. It's memory locked in the computer, if you will. Unlike human memory and the frailties associated with it, this is a record that won't change. This composite memory, if you will remain the same throughout history, not subject to embellishment, nor to losses.
But at the very moment of triumph, the world was changing. The simple structure of the Cold War was beginning to disappear. Soviet power started to collapse. As it did so, memories from the past re-emerged throughout Europe. They fueled bitter rivalries that had been hidden since the end of the Second World War. 50 years ago, many hoped that these memories had been wiped forever, that the past was under control.
And now we've lived through a period in which that notion of managed memory, if I can put the thing that way, has changed. And what we get instead is this horrible emergence of the past. We haven't escaped our past. We see it all over the new states of Russia, of the Soviet, former Soviet Union. We see it all over the Bosnian War and the rest.
Flash forward to Tucker Carlson's face listening to the half an hour Putin history lecture.
And begin to have notions that are much more biological, that we're trapped in our evolutionary past, that we're victims of our history. We then become slaves of the past. We become tragic. We become victims, basically, of the past and of fate.
That guy is a psycho. That guy who just gave that monologue is a true utopian psychopath.
The idea that it was possible to free human beings from the ghosts of the past was a noble dream. It was part of an age that believed it could control history by manipulating human memory. That age is now over, and we are caught up by the irrational forces of the past once again. Except for a few individuals who live in a different world, a world free of memory.
What had been done to me was wrong and horrible, but I was freed up because I didn't have any memory. I didn't have to worry about a memory. I was exactly who I had shaped myself into being, and people kept wanting to feel sorry for me and that I was a victim.
That is the liberal dream she's describing right there. This is like pure utopian liberalism right there. Ground zero. Pol Pot without the mass graves.
I understand that because they were horrible experiments, but on a personal, individual basis, I was not a victim because I was freed up from any of the garbage that people who have memory carry around with them all the time. Memory is a dangerous thing. Not just for individuals, but for whole societies, for cultures. They keep looking backwards and trying to relive and reshape the past when they can't. And they know they can't, but it keeps pulling them backwards, and they keep reliving the stuff that happened.
But that is a society, isn't it? What is a culture if not its shared memory? They want to live in this kind of ground zero, eternal, perpetual present with no past or no future or nothing. I felt that way. I remember me and Radlib went to New York for a conference once, and we went to the site of Ground Zero, and they've built this hideous, it's called like the One Center, where the World Trade Center used to be. And I remember Radlib, he turned to me and I said, I absolutely hate it here. He said, I hate what this mall here is. One of the most soulless places I've ever been. And it was like this place from nowhere that she is describing. Even though we were at the site of 9/11, it was still as if that place had no memory of anything. Horrible. This is like non-human, basically. Maybe when they talk about transhumanism, this is the shit they're talking about.
And I'm free of that.
Wow, that was mind-blowing. That may be the best Curtis we've watched yet. Well, certainly in terms of impact and he's really getting into his stride now. It was well, that was a very well crafted piece as well. Kind of confusing as to what he was saying, really, at the end there. Was he endorsing that, or was he just kind of, I don't know, this is what Curtis does. He throws out these kind of little hooks, but he doesn't really give you any conclusions. Takes you 80% of the way. Yeah, that was a very good one. That may be one of the best ones we've seen so far. Although I really do like Oceans Apart as a kind of set that we watched. Especially the couple on Churchill, I remember. But this was a good one. All right, so let's just hit some super chats and we'll get out of here so I can get back to RimWorld. Coney, current year, says, would you consider doing a stream on hermeticism, possibly with someone esoterically versed? I probably wouldn't, Coney, because I can't make head nor tail of it. I've read Evola's The Hermetic Tradition twice and couldn't tell you what it was about at all. There's something about hermeticism that leaves me confused, basically. So I don't really get it. Although I have watched a few videos of that alchemist woman. If she wanted to talk, I would talk to her. Whether she talked to me or not, I don't know. She's a pretty weird woman, though. She's made some good videos. Cringewalker says, my high school showed up Penfield's operations to shock us into rejecting all those fields of study. Rukunenko did even more shocking stuff. Narco Republican said, have you come across the concept of filmology, coined by one Gilbert Cohen Seat, with the aim of studying mid-century German film propaganda and how to apply it for post-war aims? I have not come across that. It sounds interesting, though. One of the things that did strike me watching this, is I wonder how much the CIA puts this stuff out there because they want people to know it. They want people to believe they're all powerful in some way. Does that make sense? You got to think, like, why are these CIA guys willing to cooperate with the BBC and Adam Curtis in the making of this documentary? And I do wonder sometimes whether the CIA sometimes leans into these things so that people do actually believe that they are truly all powerful in this way. It could be like a kind of, you know, another level of a psychological operation, if that makes any sense. Dylan Roth says, let's take a look at cigar smokers around table. Churchill, Freud, every non-white third world crackpot dictator. You are better than these people. Yeah, that may be so, Dylan Roth, but I like smoking cigars. I like the flavors that you get from different ones. The Paul Arango and its sweet, salted caramel tastes. The Juan Lopez II that I had earlier on, which is got a mixture of dark chocolate and citrus. You know, it's a nice thing to be into. You know, makes you slow down, appreciate something, get a bit connoisseur. You know, enjoyment from it. Yeah, it's good. I like it. Cringe Walker says, a YouTuber by the name of Peach Cobbler did a great deep dive on the CIA's crimes against history. Well, I'll have to check that out. Peach Cobbler, okay. Coney says, this episode makes me think how much damage something like Neuralink could do to people. I think there's a very good reason why many people in our sphere are suspicious of Musk. I agree, Coney, and I watching this, I don't believe that Musk is independent of all of this at all. How could he be? How could the CIA lose that much power in so short amount of time? And listening to all of the spooks on Judge Knapp, there's no reason to believe. It seems like they're more powerful than ever, that they control you know, that they control and don't even consult the White House a lot of the time, according to the Judge Knapp guy. So there's no reason to believe that they were just kind of, if they weren't up for Musk owning Twitter, they wouldn't have let it happen. I'm convinced of that. Which then makes you think, well, why did they let it happen? But if you accept my idea that they want to put the woke away, you know, in order to save the social fabric of America or whatever bullshit, or get people ready for World War III or whatever their reasons are, it starts making a lot more sense, I think. Frederick, 1483, says, cats are glowies, I knew it. That was a hilarious part of it. It was almost like kind of three or four films in one, wasn't it? Kind of one to watch like one or two, maybe possibly even three or four times, this one. Cringewalker says, Acoustic Kitty was a case study in school of why government oversight is necessary, literally herding cats. Cringewalker revealing that he went to weird, dark CIA school or something. Like, who was watching this stuff in school, you know? Lunham said, the CIA in this doc equals average RimWorld player. I don't know, it made my RimWorld look like a utopia. At least things work in my RimWorld. Darth Killoon says, to answer where yesterday, I will be critic to where I am deploying to. It is a country ruled by a house with an S name and it has a Muslim cube in it, making it a riddle for operational security. I mean, you weren't that subtle, mate, were you? I mean, you don't have to be Henry Kissinger to work out where you're talking about. Matt Bell says, thank God this is history. It couldn't happen now. Yeah, I know. Mr. Cheerful says, the CIA are the prime mover of the gay. Well, I mean, the thing is that whenever you start talking about the CIA, it starts like you start sounding like a conspiracy guy or something. But the more I've read and the more I've learned and heard, basically they are the Schmittian exception in the gay. They are that, you know, they have no oversight. They can do what they want. They're not really accountable to anyone. They kind of have to tell the president stuff if they want to. They can kind of do what they want, the CIA. So that does make them the prime mover, because they basically operate in a world without rules. That makes them the prime. I think you're right. They are the prime mover. Matt Bell says, for some reason, the name Fauci comes to mind. Well, that Dr. Cameron made Fauci look like a teddy bear. Frederick says, I typically don't recommend Lex Friedman tier slop like this, but a recent round of podcast appearances by CIA Foreign Service officer Andrew Bustamonte are interesting and heavy on these ideas. That is Andrew Bustamonte. I'll have a look around. I don't know if I can handle Friedman for any amount of time, but I'll see what else he's done. Cringewalker says, many algorithms that AI use stem from these CIA tests. The ghosts of the CIA's victims still echo in the machine. Dark, very dark, Cringewalker, very dark. Unoriginal username says, great content as always, AA. Thanks for years of amazing work. Well, thanks a lot for that. Cringewalker says, fun fact, East German facial recognition software was based on physiognomy. I'll DM you a manual of it. Yeah, I believe it. I believe that, I mean, now with the facial recognition technology that they've got, they've basically proved that physiognomy is real and is a good predictor of criminality. Unoriginal username says, everyone make sure to subscribe to Britannica, as Callum has chosen to part ways with the Lotus Eaters. Yes, I saw that. Callum has left Lotus Eaters now. I think that was announced a couple of days ago. And is going to do more stuff on his Britannica channel, where he does kind of like weird travelings, things like that. He does a lot of like in real life journalism, I guess you'd call it, or travel, video travel logs, things like that. Maxwell Bliss says, René Girard said that churches stopped preaching apocalyptic texts after the bomb because they wanted to reassure people this is modern rationality. Sounds likely. Belfarus Knight says, Americans wanted freedom. Here's your freedom from the past and society. Well, I mean, the thing is that watching all of this stuff, I mean, I've made a number of videos where I've said that, you know, they talk about totalitarian regimes and the quote unquote free world. And what James Burnham taught us in Managerial Revolution and the Machiavellians was basically that the World War II was three totalitarian powers, right? And this is the true meaning of George Orwell's 1984 as well. You know, FDR's America, Hitler's Germany, and Stalin's Russia were three totalitarian managerial states. And Britain was as well. But let's count Britain and America together, even though there's two countries there. But Britain was no less totalitarian. If anything, it was more centralized than America was. What Curtis does in these documentaries is he basically shows the receipts. He's lit every single episode. He's just showing the receipts of that basic thesis that, you know, basically people in America were no less brainwashed, no less propagandized, no more free, and their government was no less evil. That's basically what Curtis shows every single week without fail. All right. I think that's it for Super Chats. Thank you very much. Let us not outstay our welcome. Have a good weekend, everyone. I'll be back on Monday. Do buy my courses. Join the channel. Give a kiss to your loved ones. Most importantly of all, get out.
We're going on in this town, isn't it, human?
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Well, maybe you should have been living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.
Up yours, woke moralists. We'll see who cancels who.